if you have noticed, when you've gotten your paychecks, if you work here in Indianapolis and Marion County, you may have noticed that the portion that is your county income tax is a few pennies higher in your check. Because the county option income tax increase that goes to public safety kicked in at the first of the year. And we thought this was a good opportunity, a new year, getting people in. And we have all of these candidates who are running for mayor of Indianapolis and Marion County will be on the program next week in our 2 o'clock hour, the five major candidates that we know about, 2 Democrats, 3 Republicans. We thought it was a good time to find out what's on the minds of the men and women of law enforcement. The last time Rick Snyder was here, he was vice president of Fraternal Order of Police Lodge 86. That is the organization that represents the men and women of law enforcement, not just in IMPD, but also our Marion County Sheriff's deputies as well. Rick is now president. That means he's moved up. He doesn't have a uniform on, but if he did, he might have a star or a chevron or something like that. But Rick Snyder is the president of FOP Lodge 86, and he joins me live. Rick, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having us back. Happy New Year to you.
How would you categorize, we start with IMPD, how would you categorize the mood and morale of the men and women in blue?
Well, obviously, for the past few years, it's been a difficult time for our officers going through a lot of administrative changes as well as severe financial challenges that the city and the police department has faced. And then without a doubt, in recent months here, it's become more and more difficult with some of the tone of other events that have taken place throughout the country that's impacted the morale of our officers as it relates to just the overall sense of satisfaction with our profession and what we do, our mission, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
However, I would say here in Indianapolis, we've been fortunate because we've been about 10 months ahead of the cycle in terms of community support and building that support with our community. Unfortunately, it's come out of tragedies that have occurred on our police department through the summer with Officer Wren's murder and all the attacks that have been occurring on our officers. So while challenging, I would say that morale is up. Morale is higher right now amongst our officers, and a good deal of that has to do with a good working relationship, I believe, between the Director of Public Safety, the Chief of Police, as well as the FOP.
At this time a year ago, we were at 19 criminal homicides or 19 homicides using how the STAR counts. There's so much confusion of how you count. We were at 19 then. As of today, we're at 8 with basically 2.5 days, to go. So unless there is just some horrific tragedy, in the next 2 days and a half, we're starting this year far lower in terms of murders in this city. Again, knock on wood, it could all, you know, go south in terms of February, but that sounds like a positive. We're at least starting the year a lot better than we started the last 2 years.
Starting better, but let's be upfront.
Eight
to nine tragedies too many.
Right.
And trust me, our officers feel that. And they, more than anyone who are out there trying to prevent these things from occurring day in and day out, feel the impact of that. And they take that personally. And, you know, we listen to Director Riggs, and he makes a good point. Everyone in our community should take any murder, any criminal death in our community personally, and we should be personally offended by that.
Mm-hmm.
And we couldn't agree more. And so while that is a better start, there's plenty of room for us to improve.
I guess last week the City County Council, they were being briefed on how many officers the Department of Public Safety and IMPD were planning to add this year in terms of a couple of recruit classes. And then I think the counselors were also finding out how many officers retired last year.
Yeah.
And they were figuring out, and the council was saying on a bipartisan basis, both Democrats and Republicans saying, wait a minute, we're not adding enough. We've told the people of Marion County that we were increasing their taxes to put net more officers on the street, and that doesn't seem to be happening. And that's what you guys were warning all last year. If we're
going
to do this, it needs to be a net increase because we just natural attrition is 30 to 40 to 50 officers a year.
Yes, sir. You know, a couple key points that you made there, Amos, is number one, you saw a response in a bipartisan fashion from the council.
Mm-hmm.
So that bears repeating, a bipartisan agreement from the council on this issue. That's huge and that's key.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that we think needs to continue as we start talking about what are we going to do with these new dollars that we have.
Mm-hmm.
In a bipartisan fashion, we passed the public safety tax increase, and rightfully so.
And there was a lot of emotion that night because I was sitting at home watching the council meeting. Even counselors that were against it weren't against police.
Correct.
And I think that's also a change in terms of attitude.
Well, and let's face it, we're all looking at the outcomes here.
Right.
And these outcomes affect all of us the same,
mm-hmm.
Regardless of what party folks are coming from or what persuasions they have. As citizens, the impact is there, and that's higher crime, more violent crime, and dramatic increases in these murders and violent crime. What we're now faced with is we made the case.
Right.
For the public safety tax increase. And I think, in fairness, both sides of the aisle on the council deserve credit
mm-hmm.
for stepping forward and leading on the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, the mayor's office deserves credit.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, the mayor actually proposed the increase, right. and the council followed through with getting it done.
Mm-hmm.
Now the question is, what are we going to do with those dollars? And we have to ensure that those dollars that we made that agreement with the taxpayers of Indianapolis, that those dollars are going to go where they wanted them to go, which is to the police,
mm-hmm.
for the purpose of hiring more police officers
mm-hmm.
and developing the infrastructure within the police department to be able to bring those officers through the door.
Mm-hmm.
We had the IMPD Staffing Commission that agreed in a bipartisan fashion, mm-hmm. unanimously, that we needed to hire at least 500 officers over the next 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
That then provided the platform for the funding that would be required to do that. Hence the public safety tax increase. Now we have that. That public safety tax increase is bringing in approximately $26 million a year more. Of that $26 million, that's restricted funds, if you will. So it's for dedicated purposes. Of that $26 million, approximately $16 million of that is dedicated and restricted to the IMPD.
Mm-hmm.
Now, others partake in that. The fire department, EMS, animal care and control.
Speedway, police get a little bit of it.
Lawrence, Beach Grove.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir. The prosecutor's office, the sheriff's department, of the remaining $10 million there. Of the $16 million, we're not projected to use that full amount right now for the purpose of hiring officers this year. And allow me to explain that. Previously, we have been limited by only being able to hire and train approximately 100 officers per calendar year, mm-hmm. just due to simple logistics of our training academy. Through some changes that we've made with the academy, and we have a new training academy commander out there, Major Jim Cleek,
mm-hmm.
who does a fantastic job of thinking outside the box, connecting the dots, and also looking at different ways that we can do our training while not lowering our standards,
mm-hmm.
not reducing the amount of training, but simply the timing of it and how some of the classes can overlap one another
mm-hmm.
to find additional efficiencies. Through that process, we are confident that we can hire and train at least 160 to 180 police officers in a calendar year. Through a lot of work with the Department of Public Safety, the Chief Heights Office, the Training Academy, and our partners on the council, we've confirmed that the ability is there to do that. So as we sit right now, because of that work, you saw the mayor originally propose 90 officers for 2015.
Right.
He then has increased that to 115 officers in 2015, which is an excellent step in the right direction. We believe that we can actually do more. And what we are saying is, listen, we should front load as many as we can in the right way, while we can. We don't know what's going to happen next year, and we all know that there's going to be politics and an election and a change in administration no matter what.
Right.
We ought to front load as many officers as we can this year to ensure that we have the momentum and the traction going forward to continue on this 500 officer plan.
Correct me if I'm wrong. If 45 or how many officers retired in calendar 2014? the funding for those officers still remains in the budget. Those slots are still planted there. And the manager in me says, well, wait a minute. I'm spending a little less per officer because if there was an officer there with 20 years of service, 30 years of service, they cost more than an officer with 1 year of service, 2 years of service. So maybe that's some extra money I can afford to start another officer or two. Am I reading that correctly, that we have the dollars to bring on enough officers just to replace attrition in a year because they're already budgeted, and then out of this $16 million, we have the ability to add more?
That is correct, and you're right. That's a good management theory. Mm-hmm. However, remember, we're talking about government. So as soon as you free up dollars by officers leaving the department, everybody starts lining up to try to get some of those dollars.
Oh, they need our bookkeeper here. Our bookkeeper at the radio station, she doesn't play that.
So what we did through the staffing commission is we worked hand in hand with the Department of Public Safety, and we got an agreement from Deputy Director Valerie Washington and Director Troy Riggs and Chief Height that any future attrition dollars, those dollars freed up by officers leaving, mm-hmm. would automatically be reallocated into the IMPD budget for the purposes of hiring. Past practice had been for those dollars to be reallocated back into the general fund. They become unrestricted and they can be spent on something else.
And I think council members, both on the Democratic and Republican side, and I think some of the Republican council members have been very vocal of making sure that public safety tax money goes to public safety, and they're watching the money as a hawk. They don't want it to go back to the general fund. They don't want it to go to paper clips in the auditor's office or paper clips in the Department of Public Works. They want it to be what they voted for.
Well, and here's the two schools of thoughts. You have two differing views. I think there's common ground, though. There is the perspective that right now, with the 115 officers that have been proposed by the mayor, we actually have current funding for up to 140 officers this year. Even with that, it leaves a fund balance of those restricted dollars dedicated to IMPD of approximately $8 to $9 million of that $16 million pot that we were dealing with. So the question becomes, what do we do with those dollars? There is one school of thought out there that says take $6 million of that, pay it back into the fiscal stability fund, where $6 million were taken out a year ago to do the initial hiring class of officers. It was one-time spending. From the FOP perspective, we just simply disagree, and here's why. Mm-hmm. While that can make good financial fiscal sense, we don't downplay that at all. Right. The timing and the priorities don't match. Mm-hmm. We are still in this crisis mode, and again, we need to front load these dollars for the purpose of getting these officers out on the street. So what we have suggested is, rather than putting that into the fiscal stability fund, which, remember this theme, then becomes unrestricted dollars and can be spent on something else, we have said the taxpayers gave you this money for this purpose. Hire as many officers as you can. Take the fund balance of $8 to $9 million and beef up your infrastructure needs. Those being this: more cars, which are in dire need of replacement. Enhance our infrastructure with our firearms training range. Amos, we have some of the best firearms training in the country. Our range, though, is not keeping the physical site is not keeping pace with the amount of training.
Is that the range out on Post Road? Or is that the range in Eagle Creek?
That's the range at Eagle Creek.
Is part of the reason it can't be expanded because it's in Eagle Creek?
Actually, there is room there for it to be expanded. And it's not as much of the need to expand it as it is to rehab the existing site and the existing bays where we do the training.
So that it is
up to standards.
So it's like going to the FBI range or the Secret Service range or the SEAL range. And I didn't mean that from a military standpoint, but somewhere where, you know, you can learn to use the firearm responsibly.
Well, and many of those agencies you just outlined actually come and participate in our training with us because it's of such a high caliber.
Okay.
However, again, the physical site has deteriorated to the point that we cannot continue moving forward to not only do the training for our officers we have, but bring in our new recruits and get them trained as well.
So part of the reason, and that the need for the dollars is not just to hire human beings to be police officers, it is that infrastructure.
Absolutely.
Let me go back to cars. Because, you know, driving around, having seen some of the cars, they do kind of look long in the tooth. And I know this current administration has had this thing about we need hybrid cars, the price of fuel and importing oil and all this kind of stuff. And we're sitting here with $2 gas, $1.90 gas.
Yeah.
Given the lower cost, given the fact that you really cannot have a hybrid police car,
right,
because a hybrid, you can't chase somebody responsibly because the bad guy doesn't have the hybrid car. They got the V8 and they can do everything. Are we at a point where, because of the price of fuel right now and what is projected to be for at least this year, this may be the time to go buy, you know, call up Chevrolet, call up Chrysler, call up Ford, and, you know, order some police specials?
Well, here's what we've done. And you know what? I give credit where credit is due. The thought process with the higher fuel ratings, and when you listen to the mayor's proposal on the need for hybrid cars and less fuel dependency, right, foreign fuel dependency, I think there's some common ground there. However, you make a point. You cannot use those types of vehicles for regular field police work. Mm-hmm. So in doing that, hats off to our managers who have made this fleet, which is on its last leg, right, last as long as they possibly could. Mm-hmm. If you listen to the director, he makes a good point. We're going to ensure that we're spending our money as fiscally responsible as possible before we come and ask for anything mm-hmm. more. That's what we've done. That's where we're at. Now we have now transferred the police model. We're going to a new model of a police vehicle for field purposes. That is the police interceptor. It is a different model than the Ford Crown Vic, which is what traditionally you have seen.
Right.
These new vehicles are all-wheel drive, which is critically important, especially for our inclement weather around here, mm-hmm. and they're more efficient and durable for our police needs. The problem with that, though, is by transferring to this new platform, gone are the days where we can piecemeal cars together. So if we had a Crown Vic that went down and maybe it needed a rear axle, take it off another old one that was broken down.
Right.
You're not going to be able to do that with these new police interceptors. And so in doing that, we have purchased some of those already, but we are talking of the need of approximately 250 new vehicles this year.
Mm.
The funding is there to do it.
Okay.
So we could do that, which would cost about $6.62 million. The remaining balance then can be divided for about $1 million plus to go to rehabbing and reengineering our firearms training range, mm-hmm. which again is an investment,
right,
because it's not, the range training is not just about how to shoot better. It is also how to better de-escalate situations and hopefully avoid the need or the cause to ever utilize the firearm to begin with.
It's like that old movie, what was that? The movie a long time ago called The FBI Story that Jimmy Stewart was in, and there's that range at the FBI base at Quantico where you're supposed to walk down the street.
Right.
And it tests the FBI agent to know when is the responsible time to use,
correct,
firearms, when it's not. So
correct.
That we don't have that. All it is just you go in between the blocks and.
No, we do have that.
We do have that. Okay.
We do have that. And that's when we're talking about our TAC bays out there. It's not just about standing on a line and shooting at a paper target.
Mm-hmm.
We are way beyond that. And that's good news. Our department really focuses on decision making, tactics that are to be used to de-escalate situations and to have a multi-dimensional scene, if you will, that you're training with, not just the paper target that you're standing on the line shooting at. But that facility is broken down to the point where we're not going to be able to continue to do that. That's why we need to rehab
that. And
it
doesn't, may not have the holograms and the modern electronics that allows,
correct,
those officers to war game.
Correct. And we're,
maybe that's the wrong term, to simulate. There we go.
To simulate.
Yeah, simulate.
And along those lines, we're looking at better simunitions training, which is just not shooting actual bullets, but using simunitions where our trainers can actually shoot back at the officers to get them thinking about taking cover and doing things such as that.
We're talking with Rick Snyder. He's the head of the FOP. 239-1310. 239-1310. You may have questions. Here's one of the biggest questions I get from listeners when we're talking police community relations. They're asking, whatever happened to officer friendly? Where can we get back to officer friendly? Somebody going in to the school, somebody going out into the community. And given that the priority of the regular officers is to be out in the neighborhoods fighting crime and dealing with crime prevention, not necessarily community relations. I think the department has kind of cut back on that. Should we be looking at figuring out a way to engage retired officers, whether they're retired African-American, retired white, retired Latino, who could be those officer friendlies, who could be those officers that go out in the community. One of the best examples came in the midst of that Castleton mess the other month. Lady calls up here, and she was out there in the midst of that, and she saw a couple of the officers with what she thought was a lethal-looking, mean-looking weapon. And she said, why did they have that kind of weapon? I said, wait a minute, what did the weapon look like? I said, it kind of looked like kind of Star Wars-y. And kind of, she said, yeah. I said, well, there's no bullets in that. There's pellets, and it is a non-lethal weapon designed for crowd control. And I said, the first time I saw that weapon was downtown at an expo, scared me to death until I went up and asked an officer, what is that? I said, now, in that, the heat of that moment, that's not necessarily a good time for a citizen, a resident, to ask an officer, what the heck are you carrying? But those are the kinds of things. Is that part of also what we need in terms of engaging the community and engaging law enforcement? I don't think we don't have enough officers to do that. Is that when do we need to engage the retired officer?
Well, and you identified two key points there, one of which is when you're talking about less lethal munitions such as that, you're also talking about technology, if you will, right, within the field of use of force and weaponry. That's another key point of making sure that we keep pace with the technology that is available to us. The only way we can do that is through the investment of the articles themselves, as well as the training that goes along with that. Right. The second component related to, I love saying officer friendly as well. Mm-hmm. And, you are aware of, the FOP has been working very diligently to help fill those gaps, if you will, where the department can no longer do some of the things, such as the McGruff Crime Dog Program. Right. The FOP has worked very diligently, and we have launched our own McGruff Crime Dog Program to help support the police department in that effort. We've also launched youth education and crime prevention components, and we've also put forward a model of community policing, which we believe in 100%. Which is called the EPIC Community Policing Model. That stands for education, which is what you're talking about, mm-hmm, prevention, intervention, and community collaboration, EPIC, EPIC Community Policing. And that's exactly what you're talking about, Amos. But again, it takes resources. Community policing is not cheaper than traditional, regular, historic policing that people think of. Community policing, problem-oriented policing, is more expensive because it takes additional resources. However, if you make the investment, you save money, save lives, and enhance your community relations moving forward in the future, and that's what we support.
239-1310, 239-1310's afternoon's name is. We're talking with Rick Snyder, president of the Fraternal Order of Police, Lodge 86. When we come back, we'll ask him about diversity in the FOP. In other words, is everybody, if you're an IMPD officer, a Marion County Sheriff, are you automatically in the FOP? Just as if you were an auto worker, are you automatically in the UAW? Or if you're a postal worker, you're automatically in one of the postal workers unions? 239-1310. 239-1310 is afternoon's name. It's after these.
Hello, this is King Ro Conley, and you're listening to Afternoons with Amos on AM 1310, The Light.
239-1310, 239-1310's afternoon's name is with Rick Snyder, president of FOP Lodge 86 that represents the men and women of law enforcement around here. If someone is an IMPD officer or a Marion County Sheriff's deputy, are they automatically members of the Fraternal Order of Police?
No.
No.
So members for the FOP have to select in. So it is not like a traditional trade union where some of those start off by being in the union as a matter of their occupation and being hired. So every one of our members opts into the membership of the FOP. We do not just represent the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department. They are our largest agency that we work with. Mm-hmm. We represent over 10 different law enforcement agencies in the Indianapolis metro arena. And so we are involved in a myriad of issues, like you brought up earlier, related to Beech Grove, Speedway Police Department, and these other communities.
Let me ask the smaller ones. What are there issues different in the smaller police departments, whether they're in Marion County or whether they're in the suburbs, as there are here in IMPD?
Well, I think what you always find in policing in general are there going to be unique circumstances related to the community itself. And it's not always based on population and size and all those things. It can just be the makeup of your community. Right. Now, that being said, what you also find is there are a lot of similarities. They're just on a different scale based on size a lot of times. So the same issues and same concerns are usually being addressed or coming up in the smaller agencies, both in the community as well as on the labor management front within the police department as well. And frankly, with some of our smaller police departments, the impact is even more is even increased even more because it is on a smaller scale and it's more apparent and has a further reach, if you will, on the number of officers that it impacts.
Going back to diversity of IMPD or the diversity of IMP, of FOP units, whether it's the IMPD unit or the sheriff's unit, does the diversity of FOP members reflect the diversity or mirror very closely or exactly the diversity in IMPD or sheriff?
Yeah, actually it does. And not only within the membership, but actually one of the things that we're proud of is that it's also reflected in our representatives of the lodge as well. So for just our executive board membership alone, 31% of our board are minority. Mm-hmm. Our labor management committee, 63% of our labor management committee that addresses those day-to-day issues has a minority representation on it. And one of the things that we really dial into is looking at when we talk about diversity in law enforcement, here again, we're not just talking about race and gender. We're really focused on various backgrounds, experiences, and exposures. Because frankly, if I take all of the same race, but they all come from the same city or the same community, they don't have those other backgrounds and experiences that we can draw upon from folks from other places. And so we really try to work with, especially the IMPD, in our recruitment practices at looking at not putting ourselves into a silo of just one area or one objective that we're looking at for recruitment purposes.
Is that something the law enforcement industry in the Indianapolis area needs to talk more about? And there was a statistic that came up on the program last year, and I believe it came from the chief. And listeners, they brought up, and I think listeners' perceptions were that the majority of IMPD officers do not live in Marion County. And the chief came back and said, oh, no, it's the reverse. The vast majority of IMPD officers live in Marion County. And that went against perception that exists in the African American community, but in terms of the profile of the department, not just race, but going back to that diversity, college graduates, you know, that they live on the south side, the north side, the east side, the west side, female, those that may have majored in criminology, those that may have majored in English or liberal arts, to get a better sense of who these men and women are.
That's the key. And I think that's an effort that the FOP can help with as well, is humanizing the badge, if you will. And there's a campaign that's going on along that front, which is to say, you know, we sometimes forget to talk about this, but it's important to remember that your police officers are your neighbors as well. Mm-hmm. They're citizens of this community. Mm-hmm. And they're just as invested, I would suggest at times even more so, because they're the only ones who are dedicating themselves full time to these issues of crime, crime prevention, but also community as well. And so that's why I say we feel it just as much as most anyone else, if not more at times, because we're so heavily involved in that.
Let me start today sure. With the phones with Anonymous at 239-1310. Hi there. Anonymous, you gotta turn your radio down so I don't hear myself say myself 10 seconds after I say myself. Anonymous, are you there?
Yes, sir.
Yes, what's up?
Yeah, I have a question for Mr. Snyder. Could he explain what's the difference between, or the different functions between the Sheriff Department and IMPD? If you call 911, who's going to show up? And does the Marion County Sheriff Department, are they allowed to make traffic stops? I'll hang up and listen.
That's a great point. Here we are. What are we? Almost 10 years after the merger, and it's more confusing as to who deflated those footballs.
Yeah, eight years in, we officially merged the departments in 2007. What we did, we didn't merge the departments. We took we got rid of IPD, made it IMPD, and we took the law enforcement division of the Marion County Sheriff's Department and combine that with the IMPD. So the Marion County Sheriff's Department does still exist. It's the Marion County Sheriff's Office. And there is a difference. If you call 911, it is an IMPD officer who will be dispatched and responding to that run. However, the Marion County Sheriff's Office does have special deputies and special deputy powers inherent through the law enforcement power of the Marion County Sheriff to utilize those deputies in various roles. Their primary responsibilities are for criminal justice purposes related to the jail, APC, court security, and building security. However, they also have legislatively required roles as well, especially as it relates to our sex offender registry. Right. They are responsible for maintaining the enforcement of that, as well as a warrants division. So that warrants division and the sex offender registry is usually what folks see out in a marked sheriff's car in a marked uniform. And within that, they do make traffic stop and enforcement steps as part of their roles related to that. Now, the other component is there are also additional folks who are out there that can help support and back up our IMPD officers when needed and when called upon to do so.
So if something happens, officer down, or there's a SWAT situation, or there's something, if there's a sheriff's deputy could respond to that. And assist.
They could respond to that and assist, just as a Lawrence officer, Beech Grove officer, and whatnot. The key component in this, though, is, and this is where you start getting a split amongst people when they look at this. When they look at the purpose for merging the departments to begin with, some people, even on the council, have asked the question, why do we have so many deputies out in the field if their primary responsibilities are in the jail and court security and all those things? You know, there's compelling arguments on both sides of that divide, but what I would say is that when we focus on what our roles are and fund them appropriately, we can do great things. And I think that's becoming more and more apparent with Sheriff Layton and his focus on the Criminal Justice Center, right, and the needs that are inherent within the courts as well as the jail and security related to prisoner transports and the housing of those who are awaiting trial.
Let me go back to the phones. And Rod, hi there.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I have a three-part question that perhaps you can answer. The first question has to do with a lot of police departments around the country begin to relook at their principal in terms of why they were created and what their function are. As you know, most police departments used to utilize the non-principal, the principal that started with London Police Department years ago. So I'm wondering whether or not the FOP and IPD are beginning to look at the principles that are incorporated when you first come to police officer as to why you had this police department, what is the focus in this role. The second is a lot of African-American communities, including Indianapolis, view the police department as occupation forces, which is perhaps some attention. How did the FOP begin to stand its role in terms of diffusing that thought that you're an occupational force versus police force trying to do community policing? And the third point being, I know you're talking about diversity, but a lot of people believe or perceive that the officers who are coming into the rank, many of them from communities, have had very little contact with African Americans, and therefore bringing in a perspective of African American, and how you begin to deal with that so that that get checked on. And I'll take the answers off the air.
That's a great question. Let me start with question three and moving up. Are we at a point where once a training class is locked in, once we know these are a 70 or 80 men and women who, you know, are in there, and chances are, you know, there may be 4, 5, 6% drop, you know, wash out, but this is the next crew. Is there any reason from FOP's perspective, because, you know, part of this is protecting the rights of potential members, where the community could at least know, you know, 20 people came from Indianapolis, 15 came from Columbus, Ohio, 5 came from Ligoti, 1 came from Santa Claus, Indiana, at least knowing their hometowns without violating privacy, but at least deal with that perception that is out in the community. All these officers that get recruited all come from small towns.
Yeah, no, absolutely. In fact, here again, we have worked hand in hand with the police department, specifically IMPD, to look at our recruitment practices. We also looked in depth at best practices of other organizations and how they recruit and the methodology that they use. The thing that's important to remember with that This is exactly your point. Yes, I think, one, the greatest way to enhance your diversity of any agency is done on the front end with your hiring practices. Mm-hmm. You will very rarely ever gain more diversity as folks move through their career. In fact, you'll usually see it decline because people leave as you mm-hmm. move forward. So the way to do that is to identify what your objectives are. And again, focusing on what's your objectives with diversity. Are we simply hiring for in a diverse way for diversity's sake? Or are we looking at what the outcomes diversity brings? And that's where I fall back again, Amos, on various backgrounds, experiences, and exposures. That's critically important because even if I hire a diverse class based on race and gender, but I hired them all from the same place. Mm-hmm. Let's just say I hire them all from one portion of Indianapolis or just Indianapolis.
Or Bean Blossom, yeah.
Wherever you want to talk about, they no matter where someone comes from, they're limited by their experiences and their exposures in that community. Mm-hmm. The way that you start breaking the mold and breaking through some of these walls that we face with diversity issues is looking at what they bring to the table in terms of experiences and exposure. So when we do that, we do look at outside the box, being the city of Indianapolis, but we do look at what other communities can we reach out to? Where can we take the best of the best in terms of thought process, ideas, and to the gentleman's first question, which is our approach to policing to begin with.
Right.
We are very supportive of this idea of we should be hiring folks who are focused on a spirit of service. Long gone are the days of hiring folks who are focused on a spirit of adventure. That used to kind of be the motto of how we would try to attract people to the police service. This is a great job.
Come be Jack Webb.
There you go.
Be Adam 12.
Right? Gone are those days. It is really a spirit of service versus adventure. And that's one of the key components that we're looking at for recruits in the thought process that they have in terms of who we're going to select through our selection process. Now, in doing that, that means that you have a different approach. And back to this idea of being viewed as an occupying force, we recognize that. We are all relegated to history, if you will. We all understand that. But I think the way that you start to make that turn is to say, hey, when you're focused on a spirit of service, you are talking about community relations. You are talking about outreach. You are talking about this education and prevention component. When we talk about EPIC and we say education, prevention, intervention, and community collaboration, when we write that out, we do all capital letters except for the I. The I is lowercase. And it's to really stress to people that we're not looking at this purely intervention component where you lock up the bad guys and everybody goes home. That doesn't work anymore. It's got to be how do we prevent the crime from occurring to begin
with. But if we're training all these new men and women this way, and police officer as servant leader, police officer it's like one of Christ's disciples, you're serving. But then you got the older guys and ladies who went through training and thought they were getting ready to be Adam 12 and Jack Webb and they were trying to be the Lenny character from Law and Order. How do you reconcile it? Because we're spending all this money training all these men and women to be the servant. Then they get out there and that training thing and they get with that sergeant. The first thing that sergeant's going to say, perception. Forget everything they told you in the academy. I'm gonna train you how to do it. And then that sergeant is trying to be like Denzel in Training Day, teaching them all the wrong things.
Here's what I think bridges that gap, if you will. One of which is folks like Major Jim Cleek, who really does a good job of connecting these dots in terms of this fully integrated adult learning model, where we've broken away from the traditional top-down driven model, and you sit in a classroom, we lecture you, we tell you what you're going to do, and that's it. We are a paramilitary organization, but we've really broken the mold of saying, hey, how do you contribute to the learning experience? And through that, we take your old school folks, if you will, who have been around the block once or twice, who are on the police force, and they are in an adult learning environment with the new guys coming into the job. Right. Fortunately, we're getting those new folks coming on now. Through that integrated learning model, we break down a lot of those barriers. And what you start to find is more of a balance. So not only do you have the old school who may have more of the spirit of adventure, I would suggest to you what you're going to find is in the last 20 years, you actually have officers who want to do more community policing than what we're able to do now. But at the same time, they can tell those newer officers, at the same time that you're doing that, you also have to remain vigilant in your safety and the safety of others.
Is there in service for officers now? In other words, hey, every 2 or 3 years, you got to go to a class. And just like if you're a lawyer, you got to go to class. I mean, they sit here and have us do webinars and videos, take this.
And that's a change in philosophy as well, I would say, for the profession over time. But we actually train all the time.
Okay. So for the whole force.
The whole force. And our officers get our Nexus training, our firearms training, technology, IT training, safety training, all the time. And it's not only in the classroom, it's through scenario-based training, but it is also through e-learning capabilities,
the
through computers.
And all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely, yes.
You don't answer the question right, you got to keep going over and over.
That's right. That's
back
right.
To the phones and Brother Motep at 239-1310. Hi there.
Hey, how you doing, Amos?
Fine.
All right, I just want to say hello to Mr. FOP. Is there any hope for all God's children? I guess it is. Anyway, a couple questions real detailed here. Number one is, do you all screen the applicants that probably are ex-military? I want to bring that up because I'm ex-military. When you're in the military, you're taught to extinguish threats. That's what Dan Wilson said. That was really disturbing with the Mike Brown case when he gave his testimony and said the threat was extinguished. That's not like a normal police talk. That's military talk, which he was. And number two, why wouldn't you all want to number two, why wouldn't you all want to make some of these guys at least continue their education? Because the first 2 years of college, you get the basics. You get psychology, sociology, you get a little speech, you get in class with various people, you learn about different people, and therefore you learn de-escalation techniques. I don't care. I'm working with people and I work with the public, and a lot of times they are wrong. And yet I still have to know how to de-escalate to keep the situation from evolving. Even if I think I'm right, which I know that half the time they think that they're right, but there's a way sometimes when people are just flapping at the gums, they'll shut up eventually. They'll shut up. And third thing, the perception that FOP, I think, disturbed a lot of us, they go back to the Bizarre case. I know you guys represented him. You paid his legal fees. But then after that second DUI, he got out of Lawrence, then you guys dropped it. Why? Why did you guys drop representing him after that, considering he hadn't been convicted of anything yet? And maybe that can help clear up a little misconception or perception that we have towards the FOP. Thank you.
I appreciate that.
Sure. On the first issue with the hiring of ex-military folks, yes, we do look at our veterans, and we look at the experiences and the training that they've had as part of the recruitment cycle. However, you are correct. We also look at striking a balance there. One of the things that we have learned through our research and through scientific study on recruitment, not only recruitment and hiring, but also promotional processes, is that the idea that a military veteran is going to absolutely be a great candidate for law enforcement has been proven false. In fact, it's not necessarily considered on its own a predictor of success moving forward. It means that you have to take a balanced approach in looking at into other aspects through your recruitment and selection process. That goes again through taking a more deliberate approach in how we do this. And that's why, Amos, you saw last year where we hired 80 officers, we had nearly 3,000 applicants.
Right.
So that tells you right there it's a very selective, highly selective process. Now, in no way would we discourage military veterans from ever applying. In fact, we want them to. But just know that's not the sole thing that we base the criteria on, and it's a balanced selection process.
Yeah. He also asked them about FOP.
Yeah. Getting to the point related to the Bizarre case, it's a fair point. It caused, without a doubt, that case, first and foremost, an absolute tragedy all the way around. We've been very consistent in saying that. Mm-hmm. That went through a cycle and went through a process. And there is a process for how we represent members. It is not just a given that if there's an allegation made, there's an automatic representation by the FOP. That is not correct. Mm-hmm. We have bylaws and we have rules and we have criteria for how the decision is made to represent or not represent. The issue with the Bizard case is the manner in which that case started, mm-hmm. and the initial criminal charges that were done, and then the whole, as we all know, the whole back and forth of whether there were going to be additional charges that were related to alcohol offenses or not. Once the alcohol offense was solidified and it was there, it no longer met the criteria for representation, and that is why that went away. Mm-hmm. So, and you know what? In fairness, our immediate past president, President Owensby, I felt like did a really good job of explaining that to people. And I saw him time and time again just being stopped on the street by people and being asked that same question. That's a fair question. We have a deliberate process that we have to step through. And even when we represent people, it doesn't mean that we are always trying to defend the indefensible. It's ensuring a balanced approach to protecting, someone's rights if they meet the requirements that are necessary to get the representation to begin with.
One final quick thing. We talked a lot about training. And sometimes people see something happen with a police officer that has nothing to do with IMPD. It's some other department somewhere. And if their training is not on the same standard as the training that we're doing, or if their training is just minimal, then you could hear a quote like the last caller talked about. That's not necessarily what's happening out on the streets.
Hey, listen, the reason why we've gotten by with having 1,500 officers doing the work of 3,000, as Chief Height likes to remind us, he's right. We can all talk about why we got so short-staffed in our police department, but what every one of us ought to be grateful for are the women and men who made it work in the interim. Mm-hmm. The reason why they were able to make it work was the high-caliber training that we have. We meet and exceed national best practices with the way that we train our officers, and that's the untold story in the success of the IMPD. Most agencies facing the same challenges that we've faced with the amount of officers that we have had would not have been successful, and they would have fallen by the wayside. The only reason why we were able to keep things moving was because our officers fell back on that high caliber training. That ought to be commended. It ought to be applauded. But to your point, not every agency is like that. And the reason why is because you will find cities who don't view training as an investment. They view it as an expense. And that's why I think we're at a good
point. And some of this has been the community outcries over the years in terms of this is really what we want our police department to do. Yes, we need protecting and serving. Yes, we want it more diverse. Before I take a break, you mentioned 3,000 applicants down to the current 80. In the current class, which is very diverse, I think about close, pushing a third are minorities, whether they're African-American and women. The class before that I got to see last summer when they were out at the public safety run and they were all there looking like one for, and I'm going, that's an awful diverse group.
Yeah.
Does it mean we have finally come a long way where we have a training process that the Fraternal Order of Police seems satisfied with? We have a training process that is getting large numbers of applicants, and when the final group gets picked, it is more diverse than the county as a whole. Does that mean we have finally gotten to where my community is getting something we like, and you have a process that's fair to potential police officers and applicants?
It's both, and it's a balance, and here's what you're seeing.
That means we've come a long way.
We have come a long way, and here's a key component in that. It's not just the fact that we're hiring a more diverse workforce. Mm-hmm. It's because we're getting a more diverse candidate pool, if
coming
you will.
In.
So we've started turning the corner in terms of historically, African Americans as a whole have been less likely to even apply for the role of a police officer. Mm-hmm. We're seeing more actually applying and developing an interest and wanting to become a part of that. We're also seeing that strongly in the Latino community as well. Mm-hmm. But we're also seeing it in other groups like the Sikh community, mm-hmm. as a religious organization, a culture that places a focus on public safety. Mm-hmm. So the question becomes, how do you reach out to that culture and build those bridges to say, hey, you have a home and you have potential in the IMPD because we value your different backgrounds and experiences and exposures. That's the difference that I think we're seeing. And it's being done with the support of both labor and management.
239-1310. 239-1310 is afternoon's name. We'll take a break. We'll be back with our many moments with Rick Snyder. And then in our second hour, find out what else is on your mind. And maybe we'll find out, has just in the state's now defunct news service, what unemployment office has that individual gone to apply for unemployment? It's afternoon's with Avis for Thursday.
Hi, this is Jessica Williams Gibson, newsroom manager at the Indianapolis Recorder newspaper, and you're listening to Afternoons with Amos on AM 1310, The Light.
All right, let me go back to the phones and Anonymous. Hi there.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air. What's up?
Thank you. Amos, I'm concerned about some of the words that have been, good morning to your guest also.
Good morning.
But some of the words that have been thrown around, both by callers, about by Mr. Amos, Army, CIA, warfare, military. And so my two concerns are when we're talking about the proposed training at Eagle Creek Park and then involving the CIA in that training and the use of holograms, would this training also include tear gas agents and certain agents that are used in military warfare? And then my second question is the use of the lethal weapons. We saw assault weapons used against or at least seen in the Ferguson case, and it was mentioned that those assault weapons used rubber bullets, but of course we have to for crowd control, but we also need to know whether those assault weapons, of course, can be converted. Would you agree to real bullets? And I'll take my answer off air.
All right. Is part of this also in going back to what people see on television that happened in other cities, that it's important for law enforcement agencies in other cities to explain to their citizens, maybe what you saw we don't do here? Or yes, if it comes to that, we would use that here, because I remember when we had a Klan demonstration back in the mid-90s, and IMPD brought out equipment nobody had ever seen before, and they were prepared with tear gas if it became necessary. There are weapons that use non-lethal bullets, but I think she was talking about assault weapons, but I don't think we have assault weapons here, correct me if I'm wrong, where you can put a rubber bullet in the chamber instead of a regular bullet. It's a different kind of weapon.
Yeah, it's a completely separate weapon system. But a couple of the key points is the cross-training that we were discussing were with other law enforcement agencies, not necessarily military or as was brought up, the CIA or anything like that. The other component to that is that with some of the technology and the weaponry that are required, we also have to remember that we have differing roles here, and there are times. A good example is when you see many of the attacks that are occurring on our homeland and abroad, where our officers have to be trained to be able to facilitate both a peaceful resolution to a serious criminal terroristic attack, such as what we've seen, as well as be able to handle the day-to-day community policing efforts. And so our officers always have to be able to strike that balance and at the same time be trained to be able to utilize whatever equipment is necessary to resolve the situation. And that gets into the key component of training in terms of decision making and making sure that we have level-headed folks who can quickly identify what the problems are and the best manner in which to resolve them. Remember, we're asking these ladies and these men to make split second, I'm talking less than 1 second, decisions that will alter the lives of not just the people they're interacting with, but the officers themselves, as well as hundreds of others. And it's a very, very challenging, task that we're asking of them. The thing that we have to do is to provide them with the resources to be able to do that effectively. And that's where we get back to this training and investing in our academy, our range, our fleet, and our officers.
Somebody sent me an email at praiseindy.com on the fleet. If the city is going to go out and buy cars, should they also use that as an opportunity to spread that purchase around and allow minority-owned businesses, there are a couple of minority-owned dealers, an opportunity to bid on some of that business?
Well, we have a specific bid process that, that has to go through, and it is usually, as a matter of practice, it's been tied to a statewide bidding system. So that includes Indiana State Police as well as many other police agencies throughout the state.
So everybody's trying to buy as many cars. The more cars you buy, the less per car, because you're trying to leverage the auto deal. Are we buying from dealers or are we buying from the company and then they route it through dealers?
That's exactly how that occurs. We buy through the companies direct, and then it's routed through dealerships back to the local agency.
So they, so the automaker could insist on routing, you know, a few cars through a minority-owned business. So the minority business gets some of the pie, and then the city gets some credit for utilizing an MBE or a WBE or even a veteran-owned business.
Not only can that occur, but I'm pretty confident that there are attributes of that, not only here in Indianapolis, but throughout the state and in other states as well through the automakers.
Anonymous will be our last caller with Rick Snyder, president of the Fraternal Order of Police. Hi there.
Hi, are you talking to me?
Yeah, I'm talking to you, yes.
All right, thank you. I heard that in India, there's a caste system. Some people are considered important and other people are treated with less respect and opportunity from what I understand, although I'm not really very knowledgeable about that. And so when I think about people from India coming to the United States and doing things like becoming police officers or getting in other positions of authority, I wonder whether they are going to respect individuals' rights under the Constitution, whether they're going to try to get a mobocracy mentality going where if they don't like certain people, like say you have a disease, they want to basically eliminate you if possible, or somehow or other keep you from going through your normal daily activities. And another thing I want to say is, in regard to that, I want our constitutional rights protected. And we do have patient's bill of rights things and all that sort of thing that I want protected. And we also have medical confidentiality and all that sort of thing. Now, here's another idea.
Very quickly.
I want Americans to have gatherings, maybe once a month, or I don't know how often people could find home this. Anyway, to complain about what they don't like about our justice system and what can be done about it on all levels. And it could be rallies held at different times, different days, so that many people could show up. There could be police there. There could be lawyers there to tell people what can be done about any of these things.
Ma'am, let me let Rick Snyder respond. I think she brought up an interesting point, and this goes back to training. Making sure that people don't bring their prejudices or the prejudices of their culture to the table.
Absolutely, and at the same time, we also have the balance of not casting wide nets over cultures as well, and recognizing that the ultimate objective, as is the case, especially with our police force, is that we all must pull in the same direction with respect to individual rights and freedoms and balancing those against the states. And that's a critical component that our officers are always trying to strike the balance of for the protection of all. And again, I think that's something to be commended and applauded and supported every chance that we can.
Next week, we're having the mayoral candidates, their first extended interviews. How important, or let me rephrase this another way, how closely is law enforcement going to be listening to the mayoral candidates?
Very in-depth, because obviously public safety will probably be the number one discussion that will be on the forefront. And from an FOP perspective, we're not only going to be listening to candidates to hear what they say, how they feel about police, the crime issues that we're facing. We're also going to be looking at what have you done or what are you doing. Folks are going to have to walk the walk instead of just talking the talk, and really be able to demonstrate that.
Will you be encouraging all the candidates, whether they're in the primary or the ones that make it to the final, to ride along with officers?
Absolutely. I would encourage anyone to do that, anyone in the community, but especially if you are putting yourself out there to want to take the helm and lead our city, including our police force. You have to know what's going on out there, and you have to get engaged in that and see what the facts are. And that goes for anyone, but if you're really wanting to rise to that position and take on that responsibility, I think anyone has an obligation to do that.
Rick Snyder, the president of the Fraternal Order of Police, Lodge 86, representing the men and women of law enforcement, not only in IMPD, not only in the Marion County Sheriff's, but a number of police organizations also here in Marion County and the surrounding area. Rick, thanks very much for being with us. Glad to have you.
Thank you.